We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Running a little behind today.
Yeah, and Maria will be back next week, hopefully.
We're keeping our fingers crossed.
Assuming she gets released, yeah.
Yeah, we did make the bail, so we're looking good. All right, let's speaking of bail, starting out with local and some changes at the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah, Seattle Police Department Chief John Diaz bailed this week. He unexpectedly retired, and apparently it was his idea rather than Mayor McGinn's, and McGinn actually tried to stop him from retiring. There was some initial speculation that the mayor might have orchestrated Diaz's retirement in order to be able to name his successor before the election, which McGinn may or may not survive. But that apparently is not the case. So McGinn announced on Tuesday that he would not be naming a successor to Diaz before the election. There are a couple of reasons for this. The pragmatic one is that it's much harder to get good or qualified applicants, particularly from outside the department, if an incumbent mayor is facing a re-election that he or she may not win. It's the same as sports team or anything else. It's very, very hard to get somebody, especially at that level, if their boss may change soon after they get hired. The other reason, of course, is that McGinn's in something of a no-win situation because he's been really a shameless apologist along with Diaz and the leadership of SPD for all of the SPD's worst excesses over the past number of years. And that's going to be a real liability for him in the election this year. So no matter what he does in terms of naming another chief, it's likely to be met with hostility from at least some quarters. Instead, what we have is Interim Chief Jim Pugel, I believe is the name of it, or Pugel. I'm never quite sure.
I said Pugel, but I could be wrong.
Okay. But you should really know this because I've met the man. He's been around for a number of years. He was instrumental in SPD's handling of the WTO demonstrations in 1999. He's also been a public face of SPD during the drone and waterfront camera controversies more recently. Is generally more accountable to the public than Diaz was in his history before becoming chief. But as interim chief, he's going to be in a position for nearly a year now before the person serving as mayor next year, whether that is McGinn or somebody else, has an opportunity to name a successor, and then that successor is vetted by the city council. That's another reason for delaying the nomination, by the way, is that the two city council members most key in the council vetting and approving a nomination for SPD chief would be Bruce Harrell, who is currently the chair of the Public Safety Committee, and the former policeman Tim Burgess, and both of them are also running for mayor against McGinn. So that would virtually guarantee that the process would be politicized, and heaven forbid that. Because, you know, people might start talking about what SPD's been doing. Diaz's regime has really been a disaster, and it was predicted from the get-go because this same situation is something we've seen before. The first major decision McGinn made when he came in as mayor in the beginning of 2010 after his 2009 election was, in fact, to replace Gil Kerlikowske, who left to become part of the Obama administration. And he also inherited an interim chief who was an internal hire in John Diaz. And he chose Diaz as his permanent hire over a reform candidate, an African-American from California who had a history of reforming troubled police departments that had communities, particularly non-white communities, that did not trust them, which is pretty similar to what we have in Seattle now. Instead, he went with the status quo, and it has been a disaster. We've had a number of incidents of police violence, almost all of which targeted non-white minorities, most notably with the John T. Williams shooting in a couple of years ago. But there have been a number of others also. We had the Federal Department of Justice investigation of SPD. We had the painful and protracted negotiations with the recalcitrant McGinn, his personal lawyer, and the SPD over what reforms would be necessary. And we've had a similar foot dragging by SPD and McGinn in terms of the implementation of those reforms, which did get watered down as a consequence of that resistance. So it's pretty clear what we need in a new police chief. We need somebody to come in from outside because, as good or as bad as, Pugel might be, he is a product of a law enforcement culture within SPD, which I think we've seen time and time again. It's not just a problem with any one person. It's not a problem with Diaz, just as it wasn't a problem with Kerlikowske before him. It's top to bottom how cops are trained when they first go out on the beat, all the way to the leadership and everything in between. Their use of force, how they perceive particular types of people as the enemy, whether or not those people individually have done anything wrong or done anything to draw suspicion other than being who they are. There's just been the complete loss of trust of SPD within a number of the communities in Seattle that they allegedly serve. That trust needs to be rebuilt, and it cannot be done by an internal hire, no matter how good that internal hire might otherwise be. It has to be somebody from the outside. And I think for that reason, because of what we've seen with his stewardship of SPD, it has to be somebody other than McGinn. And one of the questions for any of the other mayoral candidates who are running this year against McGinn is, how would you handle the SPD hire? It's one of the most important questions the mayoral candidates can answer, because whether it's somebody from inside the department or whether, as was the case with Ron Davis in 2010, whether it's a candidate from outside the department who has a history of coming in and working to rebuild community trust, there's a real question of what direction SPD and the oversight of SPD is going to go. And there's also a real question of whether the city council is finally going to start taking its oversight role seriously. And all of those things should be very important in the upcoming election this year.
All right. Moving on, a significant change this week in our corporate media landscape here.
Yeah, another bad day for Seattle media. It seems to have had a number of them in recent years, but this was really one of the worst. Broadcast industry news was centered on Seattle this week because Sinclair Broadcasting, for $371 million, bought Fisher Communications, which owns Como TV and Radio, as well as KPLZ FM and KVI AM. And a number of other stations around the Northwest, mostly TV stations. But Seattle's its flagship. They're based here. This was the last locally owned network television station in Seattle. King and Cairo and Q13, all owned by out-of-town corporations already at this point. But that wasn't the reason why it was the most notable. The reason it's most notable is who the buyer is. Sinclair Broadcasting is a very conservative, Christianist broadcaster. If the name rings a bell, it's probably from 2004 when they got a lot of unwanted publicity over a couple of things that they did. One was barring their stations from airing a Nightline episode that featured stories of soldiers who had died in Iraq during the war there. Acknowledging that soldiers were dying in the war was then seen as a politically loaded thing and bad for the reelection chances of George Bush. Good for the reelection chances of George Bush was the so-called documentary that they forced all of their stations to run 2 weeks before the 2004 election, which was a Swift Boat documentary that supposedly laid out all the reasons why John Kerry invented his Vietnam War heroism. That's the kind of broadcaster that Seattle is getting now as one of its three major network TV stations, owning Como. They may well spin off all the radio stations, which is ironic because KVI under Fisher invented the conservative talk format. KVI was the first station in the country to do a full-time 24/7 conservative talk radio format, which obviously and sadly caught on far beyond anybody's expectations. But has been really a non-factor in terms of talk radio or ratings in recent years, and is mostly doing syndicated stuff now. But, the idea that this kind of broadcaster is going to come in and be a good fit in a city like Seattle, which needless to say, much of Como's existing audience does not really embrace and probably won't appreciate those kind of programming decisions and values. In a broadcaster. The other issue that's going to come up is that as with all major media acquisitions, and Sinclair is also it's been on a buying spree lately. I don't know what it is about these Christian broadcast chains, but they always seem to have tons of money that nobody else has. Funny thing that But they've been buying a number of other regional networks recently, and what they've been doing in all of them and what they have already publicly stated that they intend to do with Fisher and its stations, including Como, is to cut costs. And according to CFO of Sinclair this week, that they expect $26 million in cost synergies in the first 12 months of their ownership of Fisher. Translated, that means they're going to lay a bunch of people off and do a lot less local programming. That also is the future fate of Como, and again, a very sad day for local Seattle media, as the TV station news departments, as bad as they are, and the Seattle Times and the Stranger are about, and in the South Sound, the News Tribune are really about all we have left for local reporting media anymore. None of them does a good job with the Stranger has its moments, but they have a very small staff compared to those other outlets. It really is remarkable how much primary source local reporting has disappeared in Seattle just over the last 10 years or so. We've got a very controversial legislative session going on in Olympia right now, and there's something like 3 full-time reporters down there from anywhere in the state, because of all the cutbacks that have happened in media outlets. And so, we're not hearing about a lot of the things that get done. And it has implications not just for consumers of media, but also for how we make our public policy decisions. You know, what you don't know can and probably will hurt you.
All right, moving on to more happy news. Hempfest.
Oh, this isn't happy news either.
I know.
We do have happy news. Yeah, we do have happy news in this
hidden in our
list of issues this week. But this isn't the one. The latest annual round of Hempfest has to be treated differently from every other Seattle summer festival because stoners erupted this week because the Downtown Seattle Association and the business associations in Belltown and Queen Anne jointly sent a letter to Seattle's Office of Economic Development asking that the city not issue a permit for Hempfest in Myrtle Edwards Park this year unless it met the group's suggested conditions. And those suggested conditions were basically to kill Hempfest. The two major ones were, one, that the festival be limited to one day, and secondly, that attendance be limited to the actual capacity of the park as determined by city departments responsible for public safety. In other words, the cops. And given how crowded Myrtle Edwards Park is, and given how hostile the city has traditionally been over the years in many facets, but particularly, Hempfest has often had good relationships with the rank and file police who actually patrol the event. But in terms of the leadership, the negotiations have always been a little bit testy. So, one day, and for that one day, we want to reduce the number of people attending. 250,000 people attend Hempfest each year. It's by far the largest such festival anywhere, probably in the world, certainly in North America. And it's one of the largest summer festivals in Seattle. But the funny thing is, you hear about most of the other really large festivals in Seattle now are done at Seattle Center. You think of Bite of Seattle, you think of Bumbershoot and Folklife, you think of Gay Pride, and they're basically in the same neighborhood in terms of the residential and business areas that are affected by a large number of people's descending from other parts of the city and region and state, and yet you don't get these kind of complaints about those particular events, even though they face exactly the same logistical challenges for other residents or businesses in the area, with the conspicuous exception that you would think that restaurants and bars, and remember, these are the same business people who whined endlessly about the Sonics leaving because they would lose so many jobs and it would so badly hurt the restaurants in Queen Anne and so forth. Key Arena holds 12,000 people. So you're talking about an event that has 20 times as many people as Key Arena's capacity. And not only 20 times the number of people, but many of those people have the munchies. So, so you really wonder where they're coming from. And, I think what it basically comes down to is that even though it is now legal, you've got a lot of people who are stuck in the mindset of, you know, cannabis equals bad and a bite of Seattle equals good, even though they're closely related events.
Well, speaking of events, some changes announced this week at Seafair.
Yeah, we had speaking of summer festivals, the Blue Angels canceling out, as had been threatened by the Navy earlier this year. They said if the sequestration cuts went through at the federal budget, that they would have to cut back, and that would include their air shows for the rest of the year. And on Monday, they did in fact announce that. And on Tuesday, immediately thereafter, Seafair rolled out its alternate plan, something called the Patriots Jet Team, which they can't be that patriotic because their jets they're flying were made in the Czech Republic. There'll also be no Seafair July 4th ship tours of the big destroyers and aircraft carriers occasionally that they get in. I think one year they had a nuclear submarine. It's remarkable in the local media and political establishment how uniformly the loss of the Blue Angels was mourned by people, because a lot of people frankly hate the Blue Angels. Their voices are almost never heard. People who don't like it because it's tax-funded militarist propaganda, because it celebrates war as entertainment and not even just normal, but something to bring the kids and be inspired by, or even just because it freaks out your dog or cat. It's kind of disturbing how Seafair has to have its celebrations of the military. I recognize it's part of the region's heritage, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not a part of the region's heritage that should be entertainment and entertainment for kids. And that probably is the most disturbing part of this whole spectacle of not just the Blue Angels canceling, but we have to have a replacement for them.
Mm. All right. Moving on to national and developments this week regarding fracking.
Yeah, some good news, because, you know, we try and do that every now and then. A federal judge in California has halted the 2011 BLM sale of four Central California land leases intended to be used for fracking. And in ruling that the BLM had violated the National Environmental Protection Act by relying on outdated reports and failing to take in the specific environmental impacts of fracking into account when it's conducting its environmental review, that judge set a precedent, because it's the first time that a federal court has acknowledged that fracking has unique and destructive environmental consequences. Now, he did not, as plaintiffs had asked, rescind the sale. He asked for further input on how to remedy the situation, and the court is going to convene on Monday to look at those plans. So the defendant and plaintiff only had a week to prepare alternatives. But it sets an important precedent, and it's important for a couple of reasons. That's one of them, presumably in the future, federal courts will look at the science. Traditionally, because there have been lawsuits all over the country around fracking, but those courts have basically deferred to the quote unquote science of industry experts who say, oh no, it's fine, there's no problems. There's now enough history of fracking over the last several years and enough independent study that's been done of it to pretty conclusively demonstrate that, yeah, there actually are problems, and then they're pretty darn significant. The second reason it's a big deal is that California has by far the largest oil shale deposits that are being targeted for fracking. It's unusually deep, more than 2 miles below the Earth's surface, 12,000 feet. But a formation called the Monterey Shale Formation holds something like 64% of the country's oil shale, extractable oil shale. And so the industry is looking at California, and some politicians and industry people in California are very excited about the prospect of a big oil boom in California. But there's a few problems with that. One is that much of California's economy now and much of the nation's food supply now comes from California's agricultural industry, which uses huge amounts of the state's water. That's already under stress because California has been under a severe long-time drought that is being caused in part by climate change, the same climate change being promoted by the same oil industry that's doing the fracking. And so that drought is likely to become more of a thing in the future, as one of the predicted impacts of climate change is going to be the desertification of places like California. So there's very scarce water. The water that is there, fracking uses a lot of water. It contaminates a lot of water. The whole idea is to put this toxic stew of chemicals into the water, inject it far into the earth, and then watch as it leaches into the groundwater. The other serious problem with fracking is that it tends to cause earthquakes. Yes, they want to do it in California. Probably not a good idea. Anyway, so that now is being challenged, and it is a court ruling that can be used in the future. The fracking opposition in California is really broad and really well organized, and they have just handed fracking opponents around the country everywhere a big victory. So, good news.
All right. Moving on, new items in the alternate from the alternate universe this week.
Yeah, Jay-Z and Beyoncé, two people I never thought I'd be talking about on this program, but they took their wedding anniversary in Cuba a couple of weeks ago, and now Republican lawmakers from South Florida, of course, have convinced the Treasury Department to investigate them for violating the embargo, which actually is kind of good news, because it will actually remind people that, yes, there still is a travel ban to Cuba. There still is an embargo to Cuba, even though the Cold War has been dead for 22 years. And it's been going on for half a century. And basically, the only impact it has is to make the lives of Cuban citizens miserable. I don't think it's going to overthrow the Cuban government at this point. And, you know, the Iron Curtain is down, and Fidel Castro is no longer in power. And why don't we just end the darn thing? Also, in the alternate universe, the same Republican-controlled North Carolina legislature that we talked about last week is wanting to impose a state religion and make it impossible for college students to vote, and the federal constitution doesn't apply because we say so, is back this week with something called the Healthy Marriage Act, so as to fix your troubled marriage. It would, among other things, force estranged couples seeking a divorce to wait 2 years before the divorce is finalized. In that time, the couple would be required to complete courses on improving their communication skills, on conflict resolution, and if they have kids, a class on the impact of divorce on children. Now, your abusive husband just tried to kill you, no exceptions, so you clearly need to improve your communication skills. He spent the last 2 years molesting your 8-year-old. Well, you need to find out just how badly not living with him will traumatize your child. It really is staggeringly idiotic, and a reminder once again that these people are not going to go away. They are throughout the Republican Party at the state level, all over the country. And as much as they talk about freedom and no government and get government off our backs, they're more than happy telling you exactly how to live. And it's a relic of some previous century, whether the 20th or 19th or 17th or 12th or whatever it might be.
All right. On to international and Portugal.
Yeah, the latest reminder that austerity measures never, ever work is Portugal, which 2 years ago became another European country forced by conservative politicians and international lenders to adopt austerity measures. Austerity being a euphemism for gutting social spending as a way to both slash a government's budget and redirect wealth upwards. We've heard a lot about addressing the deficit in the United States. That's through austerity measures. That's exactly what that's about. And they're touted and continue to be touted here and elsewhere, and by both President Obama and Democrats as well as Republicans, as spurring economic growth and creating jobs. And the problem with that, and this has happened now in Portugal too, is that never ever happens. The reaction is the opposite. And in Portugal this week came up with a constitutional and political crisis because the Supreme Court there stopped their prime minister from trying to impose a number of new emergency budget cut measures to supplement the budget cutting that they had already done. Why? Because in the 2 years since austerity was introduced, the budget deficit has widened rather than shrunk. The economy is expected to contract by a further 2.3% this year, and unemployment in Portugal now is 18%. This is what austerity does, and they're talking about bringing that to a country near you. Funny thing, the wealthy always do really well in those circumstances. I'm sure it's a coincidence.
All right. And Syria?
Yeah. Syria's Islamist rebel forces splintered this week over the announcement by one of the biggest coalition members called the Nusra Front that it was formally allying itself with al-Qaeda in Iraq. The move reflects both, what we've talked about a lot on this show, the divisions among the different rebel groups, and particularly the rebel military groups that the United States and Saudi Arabia have been arming steadily over the past year and a half or so. A lot of them are radical Islamists, and those radicals tend to be more cohesive because they're because they're zealots. They tend to be better organized, and when there's a power vacuum, as in the possibility of Assad falling, they tend to be very well positioned to move in and take power. That development, it gives credibility to Assad because he's been saying over and over again over the past a couple of years that his opponents are foreigners and terrorists. And, you know, in the case of the Nusra Front, both those things are generally true. That's not true with a lot of the indigenous forces opposed to the regime there. But again, because the nonviolent resistance to Assad has, with a lot of prompting from the U.S. and its allies and arming of them, morphed into a violent resistance, they've come increasingly to dominate the opposition to Assad. It should bring the question of the policy of arming those groups into question by the U.S. and its allies. And it's likely to provide fodder for hawks in this country who just want the U.S. to intervene directly militarily, as we've been hearing a lot of calls for the last couple of months, on the probably mistaken assumption that the U.S. can then control who becomes in power afterwards. So very, very messy situation once again in Syria, a war that has already killed at least 60,000 people, and shows no signs of ending anytime soon.
All right, events.
Yeah, one event this week. We've got a bunch coming up next week, but one big one this week. Actually, two, because there's tax day coming up on Monday also, so there will be groups leafleting at post offices for those few people who still file through the mail. And then also on Wednesday, rally to say no to drones here, there, or anywhere, meaning both in wars overseas and in the SPD here at home. Sponsors include the Alliance for Global Justice, Ground Zero, the Veterans for Peace, Washington Answers, Physicians for Social Responsibility, Fellowship of Reconciliation, Women of Black, and a number of others. That rally on Wednesday will be at 4 o'clock at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine in downtown Seattle.
Talking with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org, and all of the stories that you heard this morning and a couple more we didn't get to because we kind of started a little late, they are on the site, and with links and all the rest of that at eatthestate.org.